Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Arthur Henry Poole was one of the most celebrated photographers in early 20th century Ireland. An Englishman by birth, he was also one of the most well-known figures in the city of Waterford, where he lived for over four decades. Yet, in 1928, Arthur Poole disappeared almost without trace. What was even more unusual was that even though Poole was well-known in Waterford, it would be almost 3 years before many people in the city even realised he was missing. The case is all the more perplexing because it shared strange similarities with the disappearance of another person linked to the Poole family two decades earlier. This podcast shares what is a historical mystery that's been forgotten for nearly a century. Hello and welcome to the Irish History Podcast. Today's show looks at the story of Arthur Poole, a man I was only vaguely aware of until I started making a recent episode on the history of photography in Ireland. Then, in one of those strange coincidences, while I was making that episode, I was in a pub in Waterford where a picture of Lily Poole, Arthur's wife, hangs on the wall. A short biography of Lily mentioned that she was effectively widowed in 1928 when her husband Arthur disappeared. Now this left me intrigued. I went home and started digging into the story that's left me with more questions than answers, and it's been picking away at me ever since. Having reached what seems to be the end of the line in terms of research, in this podcast I'm going to share everything I've discovered with you, and I'd love to hear your opinions on this case. So get in touch at info@irishhistorypodcast.ie. Now, before we kick off today's show, I have a pretty cool update about the Irish History Podcast shop. At the moment, we have a really neat range of posters, pins, books, and lots more for fans of history and Irish history. However, the shop is about to change. Over this summer, we're going to bring in a range of new merch, but it's a small operation run from home, and the garage is only so big. So in order to stock the new merch, I need to make space. This is good news for you though, because right now we're offering 30% on everything in the Irish History Podcast shop. That's 30% off the historic badges, the books, the posters, and the pewter gifts. They've proved really popular. All you have to do is go to irishhistorypodcast.ie/shop and use the code SALE30. However, I will say this sale is limited. Once the current merch is gone, it won't be coming back. As I say, the shop is going to look very different in a few months. So don't miss out on what's a pretty unique opportunity and get yourself some really cool Irish history related books and merch at irishhistorypodcast.ie/shop with 30% off everything when you use the code SALE30. Now, let's start the show by introducing who Arthur Poole exactly was. While he would later become recognised as one of Ireland's leading photographers and a prominent citizen of the city of Waterford, Arthur Henry Poole was born in Taunton, a large town in Somerset, England. Although the Pooles were not extremely wealthy, they were a financially comfortable family. While he started life working in construction, Arthur's father Samuel relocated the family from Taunton to the poor town of Teignmouth in the neighbouring county of Devon in the 1850s, and it was there that he opened a photographic studio. Now, the history of photography is something extensively covered in an episode a few weeks ago, so it suffices to say that Samuel Poole, that's Arthur's father, was something of a pioneer in the 1850s, given photography had only been invented a decade or so earlier. Now, in Teignmouth, the Poole family did well. Samuel and his wife Mary Ann had at least 9 children, the fifth being Arthur, who was born around 1855. Meanwhile, Samuel built up a successful business, eventually opening a second shop. Now, little is known about his son Arthur's early years. He certainly showed an interest in what was becoming the family trade and worked in his father's photographic studio. However, his long-term opportunities in Devon were always limited by the fact that he was the fifth child in the family. With 2 older brothers who also worked in the family business, Arthur eventually decided to emigrate in the 1880s. However, his choice of destination, Ireland, was pretty unusual at the time. What drew Arthur Poole across the Irish Sea is unclear. He doesn't appear to have had an ancestral connection to the island, and emigration from Ireland had been a constant feature of life since the Great Hunger. The 1880s was also a time when news reports from Ireland were dominated by pretty sensational violence. The Phoenix Park murders and the Mam Traslin murders of 1882 had attracted international attention, while the dozens of people killed during the conflict known as the Land War, which raged from 1879 to 1882, were stories frequently mentioned in the British press. It is possible that Arthur Poole may have been influenced by another English photographer and artist, Edward Hughes. The connection between the two men is uncertain, but they were living in Waterford by the mid-1880s, and a close friendship between the two is recorded by the fact that they would marry 2 sisters, Elizabeth and Anne Morne, in a joint ceremony on October the 22nd, 1884. Now, Arthur married the younger of the sisters, Elizabeth, at this joint wedding. Although only 18 years of age at the time, and 9 years younger than Arthur, Elizabeth, known as Lily, was a headstrong woman, while her sister Anne, who married Arthur's friend Edward Hughes, would convert to her husband's religion, Lily refused. So while Arthur attended Sunday services in Waterford's Protestant Cathedral, Lily went to Mass in one of the city's many Catholic churches. Nevertheless, the couple appeared happy, and in the following years Lily gave birth to 4 children. While Bertram, Violet and Vivian survived into adulthood, a 4th child, baptised Augustus Horatio, died at the age of 4 months in 1889. Lily would raise her surviving children in the Catholic faith. Now, over the following decades, Arthur and Lily Poole emerged as one of the most successful and high-profile couples in Waterford. In the 1880s, Arthur, who sometimes went by Alfred for reasons that aren't entirely clear, opened an artist and photographic studio on the Mall in Waterford. Initially offering artistic sketches and photographs to clients, he would become famous as a photographer. Indeed, his photography made him a household name across the southeast of Ireland. It's difficult to appreciate the role a photographer had in communities at the time, but this was an age when cameras remained expensive, so most people recorded special occasions by going to a photographic studio. The Poole Studio was a place many people in Waterford would have visited at different times throughout their lives, and Arthur's name was synonymous with this business that was regularly advertised in newspaper adverts, which only spread his reputation. Now, the success of the family could be seen in the family home. In 1911, they occupied a prominent 11-roomed house at No. 4, the Mall, one of the main thoroughfares through Waterford. They would later move next door to an even larger house at No. 3. If you're familiar with Waterford, No. 3 is part of the Reg Pub beside Reginald's Tower today. On a personal level, Arthur also emerged as a leading citizen in Waterford and was frequently selected to sit on the grand jury in the county. That was a powerful body at the time that set local taxes and decided if serious court cases would go forward for trial. Along with this, Arthur Poole was pretty distinctive in appearance. By the early 20th century, his hair had gone completely white, and he supported a neatly trimmed walrus moustache. And while Waterford was a busy port, with plenty of English people living in the city, Arthur may well still have had a distinctive West Country accent from southwestern England, where he had grown up. Now, while the Pooles had enjoyed a pretty normal, if successful, life up to 1912, That year, they would find themselves embroiled in one of the most sensational trials that Waterford had seen in decades. On December 7, 1910, Margaret Reddy, a 24-year-old servant who worked for the Poole family, left the home on the Mall to go for a walk, something she apparently did most evenings at the end of her day's work. However, on December the 7th, when she left the house, that was the last time she was ever seen again. An investigation to look for Margaret was launched. Her family were contacted, but no trace of the woman was ever found. Eventually, 18 months later, a decapitated skull washed up on the shore of the River Shore, 2 miles from the village of Mooncoyne, where Margaret had grown up. Speculation was rife that this was not only Margaret, but also that she had been murdered. Almost immediately, her family identified the skull as being that of Margaret. It had a prominent cleft chin, as Margaret had in life, and there was still a small strip of hair that was the same colour as Margaret's. Her sister-in-law had actually taken a cutting of Margaret's hair, so she had that to compare to. Indeed, the family were so certain that this skull was Margaret, they actually buried it in a local cemetery. However, within a few weeks, it was exhumed and the skull was sent to Dublin, where tests were carried out. This analysis would only back up the family's claims in terms of the features of the skull fitting in with Margaret's appearance. It also confirmed the fact that the skull belonged to a woman. Now, meanwhile, the police in Waterford reopened the case and carried out investigations. So an inquest into Margaret's death was convened on August 1st, 1912, where all the evidence that had come to light was presented to a jury. Dr. J.R. Rowlett, who had carried out analysis of the skull, travelled from Dublin to Mooncoyne, and after being shown a photograph of Margaret, agreed with her family that the skull was in fact their daughter. He did significantly refuse to speculate on the cause of death, saying the skull was too deteriorated to say very much, and he couldn't say whether it had become detached from the body through exposure to nature or by foul means. The inquest would, however, highlight the strange actions of the Poole family surrounding the disappearance of Margaret Reddy. On December the 7th, the day she went missing, Lily Poole had told Margaret to visit a doctor. After this, Lily herself paid a visit to the same physician. The doctor would tell Lily Poole on that occasion that they should dismiss Margaret. The reasons why were never revealed at the inquest. The doctor said, given he couldn't be 100% certain Margaret was dead, he couldn't break doctor-patient confidentiality. However, he did strongly imply that Margaret Reddy had been pregnant. Lily Poole would claim that she did not dismiss or even speak to Margaret about the issue that evening before she left their home and was never seen again. However, it was Arthur Poole's actions over the following days that were really unusual. The following morning, after Margaret's disappearance, she'd only been gone about 14 hours at this point, he would travel all the way out to her home in Mooncoyne by train to ask Margaret's family if they knew where she was. This would have taken him probably a couple of hours. Now, while this could be interpreted as the actions of a conscientious employer, he did withhold key information from the family. Firstly, he didn't tell them that Margaret had attended a doctor the day before. He also didn't share key items he had gathered from Margaret's room in the Poole house. After she had gone missing, Arthur Poole had taken a letter and notes which were torn that had been left behind by Margaret. Not only did he not show them to her family, but at the inquest he claimed he had not read a single word on these notes. Yet he still saw fit to keep them for 2 years.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Recently, I had a minor argument with a close friend that brought up things from my past that I really needed to get off my chest. I think we've all been there. Now, I found therapy a really great way to work through these issues. For me, I really like online therapy, and BetterHelp is a really great online service that allows you to make space for therapy no matter how busy you are. BetterHelp is convenient, affordable, and gives you the support you need, but also works around your schedule. It's really easy to get up and running with a therapist on BetterHelp. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. You can do your sessions by text, phone, or video call, whichever suits you best. It's all about flexibility, working around your schedule. At the moment, BetterHelp are offering listeners to the show 10% off their first month. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/Irish History today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Irish History. Now, in July 1912, after the skull was found and the inquest convened, a policeman called to the pools asking for Margaret's belongings, and it was only at this point that they were pieced together. The notes would prove sensational, to say the least. One of them was actually a suicide letter, where Margaret claimed she was taking her life for unstated problems she was experiencing. Now, this ended the speculation that Margaret had been murdered in the minds of many. However, judging on the line of questioning from the Crown Prosecutor and interjections from the inquest jury, some of those present were sceptical of Arthur Poole's narrative and pressed him to explain why he hadn't read the letters himself or why he hadn't shared them with the Reddy family. He failed to answer both questions. He did say he offered them to two policemen who told him to keep the letters and notes. Neither of these men were at the inquest to corroborate this story. After what was a long hearing with multiple witnesses, the inquest jury agreed the skull was indeed that of Margaret Reddy, but could not agree how she died. Now, this was pretty damning of Arthur Poole's testimony, since he had produced what he claimed, at least, to be a suicide note written in Margaret's hand. Why the Pooles acted in the way they did is anyone's guess, but it is difficult to believe they were not covering up something, be it related to Margaret's pregnancy or something else. It's impossible to say. But given what we're about to talk about in relation to Arthur, there is a strange similarity to his disappearance and this case. Now, strange as these revelations were in 1912, it appears to have had very little impact on the Poole family standing in Waterford. Lily's own career was taking off around this point. She was actually a prominent figure in civic life in the city, sitting on the Workhouse Board of Guardians in the early 20th century. She was a feminist, and she actually stood for election to Waterford Corporation in 1912 and became only the second woman in history to win a seat on the body. After her victory, she informed the press that she would do all in her power to show that women were equal to men. While Lily remained a prominent local politician until 1920, the Poole Photographic Studio remained a household name in the city. However, everything would change in November 1928. On Friday, November the 16th, 1928, Arthur Poole, now in his early 70s, left his home in Waterford at 8 o'clock, leaving a note stating he was going to Tramore. If you're unfamiliar with Waterford, Tramore is a seaside town situated 10 miles south of the city. It was a place that Arthur must have been very familiar with. His wife Lily had been born there, while his work would have brought him to the town regularly. It's pretty picturesque, and the Strand at Tramore was used as a backdrop for many photos. It's unclear if the time of his departure, 8 o'clock, was in the morning or the evening. It seems more likely it was in the morning. It would have been dark several hours by 8 p.m. in November in the evening. How he travelled is also unclear. It was a distance, easily cycled, although Poole was about 73 in 1928, so it seems more likely he would have taken the train, which ran at the time, or drove by car. The note he left behind also said he might spend the night in Tramore. In 1928, no one said the note left any purpose for the trip. Now, Arthur Poole was never seen from or heard of again after leaving Waterford. It's unclear if he reached Tramore. When he didn't return the following day, Saturday, November the 17th, his family contacted the Gardaí. Given his high-profile nature, the limited newspaper coverage of the story and his disappearance definitely seems strange in retrospect. The only appeal for information was an article in the Waterford Standard newspaper 8 days after his disappearance. Although it seems unusual that the family would have waited this long, it is worth bearing in mind that the Waterford Standard only came out twice a week in the 1920s. The other two Waterford newspapers, the Munster Express and the Waterford News and Star, were weekly publications, so the gap between these events is not as long as it might seem. Also, in an age where telephones were relatively rare, it's understandable that a family might hold off, generating the inevitable controversy of appealing for information until they were certain a person was missing. All that said, when Margaret Reddy had disappeared back in 1910, Arthur himself had driven to her home to ask about her whereabouts just 12 hours after she was last seen. There was a surprising lack of publicity in general, though, around this case through late November and December. The Poole family had the means to take out advertisements in the national press if needed. Now, the Gardaí would later state they did investigate the disappearance but could find no evidence as to what happened. This investigation appears to have been pretty limited, however, because, as we'll see, there appears to have been little awareness in the city of Waterford that Arthur Poole remained missing. This would all change as a result of a very strange court case in 1931 when members of the Poole family fell out in a pretty spectacular and public fashion. Nearly 3 years passed with little or no reference to the disappearance of Arthur Poole until his family ended up in court in 1931 over what seemed initially to be the most trivial of matters. The issue at stake was actually a fire grate worth just £5. In September 1928, 2 months before Arthur's disappearance, his son, Vivian Poole, had called to Harper's, a hardware shop in Waterford, and ordered a grate for the Poole residence on the Mall. Rather than pay for it there and then, he had put the grate on the family account in the shop. However, by 1931, family dynamics had changed considerably, and Harper's had still not been paid. Arthur had now not been seen for over 2 years. Elizabeth had sold the family home on the Mall. Meanwhile, she and her son Vivian had had a major disagreement. The cause of this argument was never revealed, but it was extremely serious. Vivian had actually left Waterford and moved to Dublin. The depth of the animosity was so great that Vivian would not attend Lily's funeral when she died 6 years later. But back in 1931, the merchant, John Harper, had been left out of pocket. When he approached Lily Poole, she said it was up to Vivian, her son, who had ordered it, to pay for the grate. When he approached Vivian Poole, he said he had only ordered the grate on behalf of his father, so it was not his responsibility either. Ultimately, John Harper took legal action against Lily Poole, Vivian Poole, but also significantly Arthur Poole. Now, while this implied Arthur was alive somewhere, his wife Lily was also sued as an executrix, which meant she was responsible for implementing the will of her husband, which also inferred Arthur was dead. So in the same court case, it was basically being implied that Arthur was both living and dead. Now, this only highlighted the confusion that had developed around Arthur Poole's whereabouts in the city of Waterford. Indeed, when the family stated in court that Arthur was missing nearly 3 years, the Irish Press, a national newspaper, reported that this was something of a surprise for most people in the city. The newspaper would say that the general belief appears to have been that Arthur Poole was either on an extended holiday for health reasons or in a nursing home. During that case, Lily Poole's solicitor would heavily imply that Arthur had actually died by suicide back in 1928 and stated that the note he left behind before going to Tremore was, and I quote, practically a goodbye note. Vivian Poole, Arthur's son, failed to clear the matter up because he implied that he didn't agree with his mother's assertion. When solicitors representing John Harper, the hardware merchant, had written to Vivian in July 1931 threatening legal action over the grate, he responded by welcoming this court case. He had actually said, and I quote, it might be a means of throwing some light on the disappearance of his father, that is. Again, this is very strange to say the least. It implies Vivian Poole believed information as to his father's whereabouts and fate were being withheld by someone and that they might now be revealed in the case. Ultimately, nothing really new came to light in that case. It was ultimately about an unpaid bill and not Arthur's disappearance. The judge at times had to stop the case drifting into the far more sensational matter of the disappearance, and in the end he just ordered Vivian Poole to pay Harpers the £5 they were owed. Now this left the matter of Arthur Poole's disappearance a mystery. The trail pretty much runs cold at this point. There's little or no other mention of it. In spite of all the unanswered questions, Arthur Poole's disappearance is not something that went down in local folklore, as far as I can tell, or is even talked about that much in Waterford. That said, it may have been something of a controversial topic that was considered best avoided in public conversation in the city. 6 years after the 1931 case, Arthur Poole's wife, Lily, died. While her death certificate did list her as being married, as opposed to being a widow, in what was a very unusual feature for the 1930s in Ireland, her obituary in the local newspaper made no mention of her husband living, missing or dead. Vivian Poole, her son, as I say, did not attend the funeral. Arthur Poole, for his part, was never actually declared dead and his body has never been discovered. For obvious reasons, this case has perplexed me since I first looked into it. Arthur Poole was a very well-known man, not only in Waterford, but also in Ireland. He is regarded as one of the island's leading photographers in the early 20th century, and the name A.H. Poole would have been recognised across the southeast of Ireland because the firm regularly advertised in papers under his name. Yet, when he vanished without a trace in 1928, his family appeared to have acted in an oddly restrained fashion. Given their considerable resources and influence, the case could have generated national attention. In my mind, there are three possibilities or explanations. Firstly, is that Arthur Poole, for one reason or another, decided to run away and start a new life. He probably had the financial means to do this, but in 1928, he was 72, and I think this is a pretty unlikely course of events. You'd have to ask why he would do this and where he would go. The second is that he died by suicide, as Lily Poole's solicitor inferred in 1931. The stigma around suicide in Ireland at the time might explain a family's reticence to draw attention to the case, but on the other hand, one would surely think the overriding concern would have been his welfare and that they would have done all in their power to find him after he went missing. Also, the fact that Lily Poole's own solicitor offered up this information in 1931 is also strange given attitudes towards suicide at the time. The third option is that Arthur Poole was killed accidentally or intentionally and his body was secretly buried. The words of Arthur's son Vivian in 1931, that a court case might be a means of throwing some light on the disappearance, indicated that he at the very least believed the story was more complicated than had been reported. Yet, it's odd that he would only raise this issue when he was taken to court over a pretty trivial matter. Finally, you might probably be wondering why I went into such detail about the case of Margaret Reddy, but never stated outright if I thought there was a connection. This is because there's no direct link. There are, however, similarities between the disappearance of Margaret Reddy and Arthur Poole. In both instances, a claim of suicide was introduced only years later when national attention focused on the case. Finally, in my mind, probably the most surprising aspect of the Arthur Poole case lies not in his family's actions and reactions and whether they knew more, but how wider society responded. No one appears to press the matter, even though there were so many questions left unanswered after Arthur disappeared. The case appears to have been effectively brushed under the carpet for reasons unknown. Now, I'd love to hear your take on this case. What do you think happened? Let me know at info@irishhistorypodcast.ie. I'll be back next week with a new show. Until then, slán.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.